From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier, part three of Democracy Now!'s exclusive interview with jailed activist Lori Berenson from her prison in Lima, Peru. Then, the White House threatens to boycott the UN World Conference Against Racism. We'll speak with one of the grassroots organizers of the conference. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israel ran into a storm of international criticism today for its attack on the offices of a Palestinian group, which killed eight people, including two children, and triggered a wave of violence across the region amid Palestinian cries for vengeance. As the international community warned that the strike in the West Bank town of Nablus was a dangerous escalation of the 10-month conflict that has rocked the region, around 100,000 furious mourners swarmed to the Palestinian funerals. The mass assassination by Israeli helicopter gunships triggered a night of violence across the region, which left at least 11 Palestinians, including a 15-month-old baby, and five Jewish settlers injured. The House of Representatives Republican leadership yesterday postponed a vote granting U.S. President George Bush broad trade negotiating powers until after its summer recess. The move is a setback for Bush, who in recent days has stepped up his campaign to get the Trade Promotion Authority Act, formerly known as Fast Track, approved. The act would bind the Congress to a yes or no vote on any trade accord he signed, barring amendments on labor and environmental standards. Republicans postponed the vote because they didn't have enough votes from the Democrats. Meanwhile, in Geneva, divided opinions on international trade undermine support for a new round of trade negotiations to be launched at the World Trade Organization's next meeting in November in the Qatari capital, Doha, as delegates from 142 countries met for preliminary talks on Monday and Tuesday. The United States and the European Union emerged from the preparatory sessions upbeat about a new round of talks, but their optimism contrasted sharply with comments by other states and by WTO head Mike Moore, who said Monday the multilateral trade system would be threatened if member countries did not cooperate. Thousands of jobless people and state employees blocked highways across recession-stricken Argentina on Tuesday, protesting government austerity plans and demanding work. The protests were the latest outburst of anger in Argentina, which is sliding into a fourth straight year of recession, with unemployment above 16% and a quarter of the population living beneath the poverty line. On Monday, the government won congressional approval to implement deep spending cuts in state salaries and pensions to trim the growing budget deficit. In Washington yesterday, a group of elected officials from Colombia appealed for congressional and public support for their campaign to stop U.S.-funded aerial fumigation of drug crops in their country, saying the policy endangers human health and the environment and is ineffective in reducing illegal cultivation. Their appeal came as Colombia's counter-narcotics police, working with U.S. assistance, resumed the spraying program after a one-week hiatus following a Bogota judge's order shutting it down. The July 23rd order was in response to a complaint filed by Indian communities in southeastern Colombia. The fumigation policy has come under increasing criticism, both here and in Colombia. Bills to end it have been introduced in both houses of the Colombian Congress, while the United Nations Drug Control Program has called it inhumane and ineffective. Legislation was introduced in Congress yesterday to ban workplace discrimination against homosexuals, reviving a campaign to include sexual orientation in federal civil rights protection. Supporters said they expect the Senate to vote on the Employment Non-Discrimination Act this year, but that it faced an uncertain future in the House of Representatives. In 1996, similar legislation fell one vote short of Senate approval, but no such bill has ever come close to passage in the House. The Washington Post is reporting today that a company that touts its facial identification system as a powerful new tool for security and crime fighting has received millions of dollars in federal funding to improve its surveillance technology for military and intelligence uses. The company, Visionics Corporation of Jersey City, New Jersey, gained widespread notoriety after its FaceIt system was installed by Tampa police to match images caught by dozens of cameras in an entertainment district against digital mugshots of suspected criminals. But FaceIt is also being employed by a host of other government agencies, including the secretive National Security Agency, the Defense Department, the Justice Department, and the Israeli Defense Ministry. Meanwhile, House Republicans sharply criticized the use of cameras to catch motorists who run stoplights, but some Democrats at a hearing yesterday said Congress should stay out of local police issues. And this news from Middletown, Ohio, in a settlement agreement approved by the National Labor Relations Board, AK Steel has been forced to post a notice to its employees that the company will obey federal laws. In particular, the NLRB has required AK Steel to agree that the company will not engage in surveillance of USWA members at grievance meetings or other activities protected by the National Labor Relations Act. The USWA is the United Steelworkers of America.
First thing when I wake up, right before I close my eyes at night, I'm under some kind of microscope. Satellites over my head, transmitters in my dollars, hawking, watching, scoping, shocking, scrutinizing me, checking to see what I'm doing, where I be, who I see, how and where and with whom I make my money. What is this? Excuse me, miss, may I have your phone number and your social security? Who, me? When all I came to do was buy my double or triple A batteries, please, I decline.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman.
Watch your mind, gotta open it up, don't know who's been in it, tracking where I go, finding out all my business, security, video cameras locked on me, in every dressing room, on every floor, in every store, damn, can I get that democracy and equality and privacy, you busy watching me, that you're blind, baby, you neglect to see the drugs coming into my community, weapons coming into my community, dirty cops in my community, and you keep saying that I'm free, and you keep saying that I'm free, and you keep saying that I'm free. Satellites out, direct TV. Am I watching it or is it watching me? Man, I don't really know. But I feel like I'm being scoped, y'all. Watch, y'all. Something ain't right. Something ain't right.
Watching Me by Jill Scott from her CD, Who is Jill Scott? Here on Democracy Now! Today we conclude our exclusive interview with jailed U.S. activist Lori Berenson. For the past 2 days, Democracy Now! Has broken the sound barrier, bringing you the voice of Lori Berenson for the first time since she was sentenced to 20 years by a Peruvian court. We had sent Lori Berenson a series of questions and broadcast her answers from the Trios prison in Lima, Peru. Berenson has been sentenced in Peru for more than 5 years. She was first sentenced to life in prison by a hooded military court in Peru on charges that she was a leader of the MRTA, the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, a group classified as terrorist by the Peruvian government. She was transferred to Lima after the Peruvian military voided her life sentence and ordered her retried in a civilian court on reduced charges of collaborating with the MRTA. Last month, she was convicted and resentenced to 20 years in prison. In the interview that we have played so far, Lori Berenson insists she is innocent of the charges against her, says that if she had condemned the MRTA, she would probably be free by now, and says she feels her trial was used as a smokescreen by former President Alberto Fujimori and jailed intelligence chief Vladimiro Montesinos. We continue now with the interview we began broadcasting on Monday. The sound isn't optimal, but these are the conditions under which she was able to do the interview. In this final segment of the interview, Lori discusses the impact her imprisonment has had on her family and repeats excerpts of her final statement to the court from her recent trial. She reads the questions that we sent to her and she answers them. This is Lori Berenson.
The next question is that my parents have also been through an incredible ordeal, and yet they seemed more determined than ever to win my release. What has been that been like for me as a family, and looking around me in this prison, how do other families deal with having their loved ones imprisoned? I'm tremendously grateful for everything my parents have done. I think they've done it out of their moral convictions, their love for me, and I think they've done it not only for me, because they realize that my problem isn't an isolated problem, it's actually part of a much larger problem, and I really admire them for all they've done. As a family, I would say it's been a factor that's been very difficult for me to go through. I think it's very painful for me to see how my parents have dedicated so much time to this. I perhaps not only didn't expect that, but I would... It makes me feel somewhat, on one hand, very honored, and on the other hand, I feel badly for the amount of efforts they've gone through, especially since the response to all of their efforts has always been such a difficult one for them to accept. I know they're more determined than ever, as I am. I think, though it may take its time, I believe there will be a day in which the period of the context in which my case has been dealt with starts being looked at in another manner. It is my hope, at any rate, and not only my hope. I believe there's concrete evidence that when the whole policy of disinformation gets discovered, and I think it will get discovered, I think many situations like mine will have to be looked at in another light. And I know my parents' effort will always have had a very important contribution, not only in my case, but in the general situation of justice. Justice, I'm not talking about judicially, justice in a general sense of what the real meaning of justice for all. How do other families deal with their loved ones in prison? I would say here, one of the differences perhaps is that families of political prisoners probably see their family members as people who are in one way or another defending the rights of them, defending the rights of the most poor in their country, defending the rights to a history, to life, really. And I think perhaps the bigger difference between other family members and mine is the economic situation that most families must go through, especially the families of political prisoners. Most of them are from much poorer families, and not only that, defending a family member or defending it has its costs in the sense, I mean, people have been in prison for that. Not only that, it's the fact that in this society, still, just because your last name is the same one as a rebel leader, it still means that you have a harder time getting a job. It's an issue in which there has been such disinformation and such manipulation on a psychological level. The fear already still exists in that sense. So I think family members here have such an uphill battle. Even in spite of that, they do work for not only the release or defending the rights of their family members who are in jail. Also, in a certain sense, explaining who are their family members, saying, I've heard, for example, when family members, you know, my brother or my mother, my sister, my aunt, they're a social fighter, or someone who is seeking social justice. Is what those who are members of organizations that have taken up arms basically base their decision upon. It was a decision to take up arms against social injustice, and that is the way they see themselves. I suppose there are some families of prisoners who don't understand it that way, but there are many who do, and at least see the decision of their loved ones who are in jail as part of a social process. As I said in a certain a little bit earlier, I think the economic situation of most relatives is far worse than anything. Far worse, certainly far worse than the situation of my parents coming from the United States. But in addition to that, I think under the economic policies of the last 10 years, I would say, you know, most people work in the informal sector, you know, and it's certainly it's difficult to help your relatives in jail when you're trying to survive. So that's I think there are limitations, both because of fear and also because of how hard life is, because of the huge degree of social injustice that exists. What I see here in prison about the relation between families and their loved ones in prison. Basically, I could give a general idea of what I said in the courtroom. I'm innocent of the charges against me. Neither of my trials in the civilian or military court have proven me guilty of any crime. The charges against me are based on the hearsay of a federal detainee who is trying to free himself at my expense. Since the very day of my arrest, I have been called a terrorist, and it was a term that has been used and abused of in Peruvian society for far too many years, mostly because of the psychological impact of a concept that brings to mind indiscriminate violence designed to terrorize, irrational, destructive violence, deadly, senseless terror. I am not a terrorist, and I even condemn terrorism. I always have. I think it's very important that these years of political violence and the causes of political violence be understood, taking into account the great amount of disinformation that exists when there is a dictatorship or a government that uses authoritarian means to maintain itself. I think that if there have been acts that could be considered as terrorist acts, or have they been committed by the state or state agents, or had they been committed by one of the subversive groups, I think it'd be important that these acts be seen in their true magnitude and the true authors. I think one of the things that disinformation has done in these years is just group together a series of acts and call it terrorism and just use it with the whole psychological impact. And I think it's very important that when you want to construct a future, when you want to build a future, that you build it on the basis of the truth. The truth, the whole truth, and not a truth that, in this case, the state has been trying to put out and make people believe. I think it's very important that the truth of the facts and everything that has happened and why it has happened, why there was why there are organizations that decided to take up arms. I think it's very important that all of that be known. I feel very sad for all direct and indirect victims of violence. The damage to a society goes well beyond the physical and psychological impact of the violence on its victims and their families. It leaves deep wounds, very painful wounds, and it is sad to watch if we people endure it. Political violence harms a society because it is interconnected with the institutionalized violence criticized by important church authorities in the second half of the 20th century. El Salvador martyred Archbishop Oscar Romero gave his life in 1980 because of his criticism of what he called institutionalized violence, as did Bishop Juan Gerardi, martyred in Guatemala in more recent years for defending the poor and defending the truth. Hundreds and probably thousands of clergy lay workers have been assassinated for defending the poor and speaking out against social injustice and the institutionalized violence of hunger and poverty that is the horrendous daily peril of millions. When on March 20th I said my case has been used as a smokescreen, that my trial was political, it's because of the particular elements regarding my case, and as well, in general, the cases of all of those detained and tried in the context of political violence. There's a very simple reason. The existence of insurgent or rebel movements in Latin America and many other places in the world has a lot to do with social and economic conditions. The government responds through state policy, albeit solely military policy or with other components, and that is a political decision. Thus, my trial is political. These cases are political.
Lori Berenson repeating what she said at the time of her trial. She was sentenced to 20 years by a Peruvian court on June 20th. We are going to go back to her statement in just a minute here on Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue with the exclusive interview with jailed U.S. activist Lori Berenson in Peru. We sent her questions, which she reads and then gives her answers. She's now in the midst of sharing what she said in the courtroom in the time of her trial this past June. Lori Berenson.
Thousands of Peruvians have suffered persecution, detention, torture, and death as part of a state policy violating human and fundamental rights of its population. After ex-President Fujimori's self-coup in 1992, constitutional law was violated by executive decrees that made during a state of emergency. The Congress and university were closed. All forms of social organization and opposition was prohibited. The unconstitutional legislation included the anti-terrorist laws that destroyed due process in civilian and military courts. But today in Peru and throughout the world, it is common knowledge that the Peruvian state did more than violate human rights by closing democratic institutions and stomping on labor and social rights, leaving its people hungry. It is now common knowledge that behind the unconstitutional legislation and the manipulation of public opinion around certain issues like political violence, behind all that was an extremely corrupt government that profited from the blood and sweat of its citizens, condemning them to live in hunger and misery. The dictatorship manipulated the judiciary to ensure the cover-up of human rights violations and corruption. It wasn't an issue of particular judicial authorities, but the system itself and the legislation. In the cases of those tried for terrorism or treason, they were often condemned on the basis of hearsay and fabricated evidence. People were sentenced for refusing to admit guilt, regardless of whether or not they were guilty. They were condemned for not fingering others and for rejecting the psychological and social stigma of being called a terrorist. Hearsay, supposed intentions, finger-pointing, or lack thereof, personal and political opinions, none of those constitute proof of any crime. I am aware that much of the Peruvian public has a very negative image of me, which in part is because of the anger I expressed and how aggressive I came across when I was illegally presented to the press in January 1996. And I am aware of how that image and those statements were manipulated to create a monster larger than life, so that I later personified 20 years of insurgent and state violence. This was part of the propaganda designed to make people forget how government policy and corruption impoverished the Peruvian people. As I have stated in this trial, I regret having come across as such an angry, aggressive person, especially if it confused or offended the Peruvian people, whom I really respect and love. The anger I showed was the result of my indignation upon seeing not only the violation of human rights and fundamental rights of the Peruvian people, but also the suffering I witnessed in Dincote and the farce of a trial I was undergoing. The mistreatment and outright torture of my fellow detainees form only a short chapter of the history of torture in Dincote or army bases. That was a state policy. Even so, I think it was wrong of me to have expressed myself in that way, so angry. I should have said the same or similar things, but in a calmer way. However, I believe I was punished more for what I said. Not only was I given a life sentence, but also for over 5 years my name and image were used as a symbol of so-called terrorism. The punishment was for not cowering to the system of injustice and for expressing my beliefs. I explained why I was innocent of each of the charges against me. Saying how I couldn't knew people on a social basis, what I had actually done, I actually ranked or not. What I did explain is that I did not come to Peru to cause any harm. I was and I am interested in Peru's history and Peru's future. The reason I wanted to write articles about Peru was precisely because I thought it was very important that people in the United States and elsewhere know more about Peru. Peru's cultural richness should be more greatly appreciated by all. I believe that cultural history should be considered useful in the present and looking towards the future. I was seriously writing those articles. The editors of the magazines have confirmed it. My notes, my interviews with various people prove it. I knew nothing about any supposed plan that the MRTA might have had to seize the Congress. To this day, I know nothing about such a plan, or even if it existed. And if it existed, I certainly had nothing to do with it. I explained some of the contradictions of one of my co-accused, who definitely told lies to save his own skin, and how some of the declarations in court have shed light upon who this person is and what he might have known. I reiterated my innocence of the prosecutor's charges of being a member and collaborator of the MRTA. In fact, by definition, one cannot be both a member and a collaborator. I am neither, and there is no evidence to the contrary. I did not come to Peru to cause damage or harm to anyone or anything. I've always been deeply concerned with issues of poverty and social justice. If I was interested in Peru's history and its people, it was with my best intentions. When I spoke about poverty 5 years ago during my press presentation, it was because the human suffering caused by social injustice is unfair, inhumane, and downright immoral. Poverty in Peru has gotten worse since my detention. Now people talk about more sectors of poor and higher percentages of extreme poverty. And no one can deny this. Not only that, politicians, the church, everyone speaks of it. I have been very open and honest about this because it has been part of my way of life for many years. I believe that when things are wrong, one should say they are wrong. One should speak out and promote those social and moral values for all people. I am grateful the help of my family and friends, and even their presence in this trial has a lot to do with those moral values that I believe in and that they believe in. I have not hidden my opinions or my beliefs. I have been honest and transparent when expressing who I am and what I think. It has been a tremendous honor for me to have been involved in social issues for many years. It has also been a great honor for me to have worked in a country like El Salvador, working with the refugees, with the students, and working on the peace process with the FMLN. It's been certainly an honor for me to be part of that, and I think I have no reason to be ashamed of that. When I describe my work in El Salvador, or when I say that I like the music of Victor Jara, a Chilean author and singer who is cruelly assassinated by a dictatorship because of his beliefs and because of his work towards social justice, none of that makes me guilty of a crime. On the contrary, I think it makes it clear who I am and what I believe. I have nothing but love for Latin American people and the Peruvian people. I've been in jail for many years now, but I still have a great hopes, and I'm still convinced that there will be a future of justice for the people of Peru and all humanity. That is almost the entire text of what I had said. If there's anything else I'd like to add, I would say that these years that I've spent in jail have been a great learning experience in the sense of learning more about human nature, learning more about, I wouldn't say who I am, I would say learning more about what it means to defend what one believes in and defending what is correct. I think in terms of learning about human, I would say the greatness of, in terms of possibilities of human beings, I would say I have witnessed and seen so many things and lived so many things that it certainly makes me appreciate the concepts of solidarity and brotherly love and human rights in general. That would be all. Thank you very much.
Lori Berenson speaking from her prison in Lima, Peru, where she has been sentenced to 20 years. She's served 5 of those years. She is expected to be released November 29th, 2015, unless she is pardoned or released in some other way. Lori Berenson can, more information can be gotten on her case by going to the website that her family has set up at www.freelori.org. That's www.freelori.org. And if you missed any part of the last 3 days of the tape that we have played of our interview with her, the first time she's responding to journalist questions on tape to be broadcast since she was sentenced, you can go to webactive.com and hear Monday, Tuesday, and today, Wednesday's conversation. That's webactive.com. As we move now to the UN Conference Against Racism, we begin with Hugh Masekela's Stimula.
There's a train that comes from Mozambique, Angola, Zimbabwe, Malawi, Botswana, Namibia, Lesotho, Swaziland, and the whole hinterland of South Africa. This train carries on it the young men and old men who are conscripted to come and work on contract in the gold mines of Johannesburg and its surrounding metropolis. Deep down in the belly of the earth, and they digging and drilling for that mighty evasive stone. Or when they dish that mishmash mush food into their iron plates with an iron shovel. Or when they hear that choo-choo train a screaming apart from the far horizon, they always curse the coal train that brought them to Johannesburg. Steamer.
Reparations and Zionism.
If these two issues aren't struck from the agenda, the White House says it will boycott the UN conference against racism. They don't want to discuss whether Western countries should compensate victims of colonization and slavery, or whether Zionism is a movement based on racial superiority and the Israeli settlements create an apartheid-like system. Yesterday, Democratic Congressmember Cynthia McKinney had these words for the White House at the first congressional hearing on the conference. She said, "I have to wonder if the Bush administration's position on the World Conference on Racism is just politically dumb, or if it's perhaps indicative of something more malignant." She asked, "Is the Bush White House just full of latent racists?" Also yesterday, State Department officials admitted they've been engaged in a fierce lobbying effort to persuade other nations to drop the two issues. This week, a small corps of U.S. diplomats is in Geneva attending sessions with conference planners about the agenda. However, the real negotiations, one administration official said, are expected to occur behind closed doors during the next few days as the diplomats press their argument that the inclusion of the two agenda points would subvert the conference and impede any progress. We're going to talk about the preparations for this conference with Roger Wareham, who joins us in the studio now, human rights attorney and member of the December 12th movement, often a lone voice at the UN Human Rights Commission in Geneva raising the issue of human rights abuses in the United States. I remember seeing you there, Roger, close to a decade ago. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Welcome, Amy. It's good to see you. It was in 1990, after East Timor.
That's right. I saw you in, it was in 1992. You testified at the congressional hearing yesterday. What happened there?
What happened was that the Congressional Committee on Foreign Relations, its Subcommittee on International Operations and Human Rights, had a hearing to address the question of the World Conference on Human Rights. Originally, the meeting had been scheduled for last Wednesday, July 25th, so that the members of the State Department who would be attending the PrepCom that began in Geneva on the 30th would be able to testify. At the day before the hearing was to occur last Tuesday, after the hearing had been scheduled for more than a month, the chair of the committee decided to postpone the meeting, to cancel it at the last minute and to postpone it until yesterday because there was an illness or death in the family of one of her staff members, which was sort of unprecedented that a congressional hearing would be canceled because of a staff member's personal situation. What they then did was have a State Department briefing last Friday where this statement was issued that you talked about, saying that the State Department was going to boycott the conference, the U.S. was going to boycott the conference if they weren't able to remove what they wanted from the agenda. So that brought us to yesterday's hearing. At yesterday's hearings, there were statements by the chair of the committee, who is Representative Ross Linton out of Florida, Congresswoman McKinney, Congresswoman Lee, Congresswoman Carson, Congressman Engel. There were a couple of others who. Donald Payne, Congressman Payne, made statements. And then there were two panels of private citizens. There were representatives from the Simon Wiesenthal Institute, B'nai B'rith, the Anti-Defamation League, who made statements around their concern about the Zionism as racism resolution. And then it was myself and Ray Winbush of the Race Relations Institute of Fisk University.
And can you talk about your major issues? Cynthia McKinney was extremely angry, saying that she felt that what the Bush administration is focusing on should not be the focus of this conference.
Right. The issues that we focused on were three issues that we, and when I say we, the December 12th movement, right after the General Assembly finally decided to hold this World Conference Against Racism, identified three issues that we thought were extremely key to the success of the World Conference. And I say success from the perspective of people of African descent, because we view the World Conference Against Racism as the vehicle that Malcolm X was talking about before he was assassinated, when he said that if the struggle of black folks, he was talking about in the U.S. but around the world, were to progress, we had to put our issues in the international arena. We had to take it to the Commission on Human Rights. We had to begin talking about human rights so that this world conference we saw, this World Conference Against Racism and Racial Discrimination, we saw as that venue that he was talking about. So we identified three issues. One issue was the question of declaration of the transatlantic slave trade and slavery as a crime against humanity. The second issue was the declaration of reparations for people of African descent in the African diaspora and on the African continent. And the third was the question of the economic basis of racism.
And we're going to get to the explanations of those in just a minute, but we have to break for stations to identify themselves as we talk to Roger Wareham, who is a human rights attorney with the December 12th Movement, one of the major grassroots organizers around this UN World Conference Against Racism that is going to take place in Durban, South Africa, at the end of the month. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio as we continue with Roger Wareham, human rights attorney, one of the main grassroots organizers for the UN Conference Against Racism. Roger, you were just talking about the three original reasons for the conference.
Those were the three issues we identified early on to focus on based on our experience in the UN and based on our experience at other UN world conferences. We understood that if we went into a world conference with an agenda that dealt with every aspect of how racism affected our lives, which would be every aspect, you would get nothing out of it. But we thought those issues spoke to the conditions of black people wherever we were in the world and set a basis for then beginning to deal with the other manifestations of racism. So what we dealt with yesterday were those three issues. And in terms of the history of the United States government's relationship to the World Conference, because we had been preceded by two members of the State Department, William Wood and Stephen Wagonseal, who gave the appearance, or actually made the statement that, you know, the United States had been in favor of the World Conference, had co-sponsored the World Conference, and just went through a whole list of things that, at that point, by the time we testified, which was near the end of the day, they had already left because they were going to Geneva. And in my statement, I said it was a shame that they weren't there because there were points that they had made that I was going to contradict just based upon fact. And the first fact was that the United States government had been opposed to the World Conference from the time it was first proposed. We attended the World Conference on Human Rights in 1993 in Vienna. And at that point, we made a call for there to be a World Conference Against Racism because the perspective that the Western countries had taken was that from the time of the release of Nelson Mandela towards the transition phase in South Africa, that racism was no longer an issue that really needed to be dealt with as any major point in the Commission on Human Rights. And so we felt it important in 1993 to say that there needed to be a World Conference Against Racism because there had been no decrease in racism, and as a matter of fact, it was increasing despite what the situation had been in South Africa. The U.S. opposed it then. As you know, there was a World Summit on Development in Copenhagen, Denmark in 1995. There was a World Conference on Women in Beijing in 1995. The United States supported those. But following those world conferences, we raised again, what about a World Conference on Racism? The United States and the Western countries gave excuses that were beyond feeble. It was people were tired of world conferences. People were world conferenced out. There was no money. It was so absurd that just given the reality of the world and given the increase in racism, they finally had to concede when the rest of the countries in the United Nations said that there should be a world conference on racism. And the United States was, I tell you, was literally the last country of the 193 or 94 countries in the United Nations to agree to the World Conference. When the resolution was passed in the Commission on Human Rights, the next level it went to was the Economic and Social Council, and at that point the United States tried to renew the argument that there not be a World Conference. So it was disingenuous at best for them to suggest that the United States supported the World Conference. They had taken other steps. That was just the beginning. And this was even before these three issues that I spoke about were raised in terms of the United States opposition. Once those issues were raised, and the question of the transatlantic slave trade as a crime against humanity and reparations were raised, their opposition increased. In 1998, at the Commission on Human Rights, the African group of countries, and for your listeners who may not be familiar with the UN structure, within the different UN bodies, they're usually broken up into geographical blocks. There's an African group, there's an Asian and Pacific group, there's a Latin American and Caribbean group, there's a Central European, and there's a Western European and other group. And the others of the Western European group is the United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And for those who may not picture it geographically, it's really Western Europe and the settler colonies that they had set up over the centuries. And so the African group in 1998, while Clinton was president, had put forward a resolution to declare the transatlantic slave trade a crime against humanity. That resolution, had it passed in the commission, would have set the basis for reparations for people wherever we were in the diaspora, because crimes against humanity have no statute of limitations. They can always be prosecuted, just like murder. At that same time that the resolution was put forward, before it even hit the floor, President Clinton was traveling to Senegal to put forward the African Growth and Opportunity Act. From what we got from very reliable sources, that before Air Force One had even hit Dakar, President Clinton had called the president of Senegal to suggest to him that it was not in Senegal's best interest for this resolution to go forward. And Senegal was very key at this point, because Senegal was the chair of the African group, so they were the ones that were putting forward the resolution in the name of the African group. And I was in Geneva at the time of the commission, and the resolution was gone the next day, that some of the African countries that had co-sponsored, because it was a unanimous resolution amongst the African group, hadn't even known it had been withdrawn, because it was withdrawn that fast. And so I cite that as an example of the so-called diplomacy that the United States is engaged in behind closed doors. It's really a diplomacy of intimidation, of blackmail, of threats, of coercion, that those countries that support issues that the United States is opposed to are going to face dire consequences if they maintain that support. So that was another example of the United States obstruction. Part of the preparation for these world conferences, as you mentioned earlier, was that they have preparatory committee meetings. And at the preparatory committee meetings, called PrepComs, that's where the real work of the world conference goes on, so that by the time you get to the actual venue where it's being held, most of the issues have been worked out. The declaration has been pretty much fine-tuned, and the plan of action has been put forward. At the first PrepCom, which was held in Geneva in May of 2000, the United States and the Western countries, one of the proposed themes of that PrepCom for the World Conference was compensatory remedies, which is really the term that reparations comes up under, compensatory remedies. The United States delegation, which was very culturally diverse and was headed by a black woman, took the position at the PrepCom that the United States government is opposed to compensatory relief even being a theme of the World Conference. They didn't even want it discussed. They even had an earlier position that the identification of victims of racism should not be a theme of the World Conference, so that you would have a World Conference against racism that wouldn't identify who were the victims of racism. That one was another one that was so absurd they had to back off. But the question of compensatory remedies, because of the opposition of the U.S. and the Western countries, and curiously enough, Israel took the position that they were opposed to compensatory remedies and reparations being a theme of the World Conference. Because of that opposition, that theme was put in brackets, which meant it hadn't been removed, it hadn't been approved, it was going to continue to be discussed, and was put off until discussion until 2001. In the meantime, there were what they say are regional PrepComs. Regional PrepComs means that each of those regions have their own PrepCom, and sometimes national countries have their own PrepCom. Like Honduras had a PrepCom, South Africa had a PrepCom that I attended. At the Western European PrepCom, which is the one the United States and Canada normally attend, they did not attend, but they didn't have to worry because they knew that that PrepCom was not going to address the question of the transatlantic slave trade or the question of reparations or the economic basis of racism.
Can I naively ask why they're so opposed to raising the issue?
Your naivety is is well taken. They are opposed to dealing with the issue of the crime against humanity and reparations because they understand that to address those issues deals with the very nature of their existence. It deals with their history. It deals with the question of why in the year 2001 the world is divided into two camps, one of quote-unquote developed countries, the other one of underdeveloped or developing countries. And those terms are not cultural terms or terms in terms of civilization. They're terms that reflect industrial and material development. The basis of the existence of the United States and Western Europe as advanced technological and industrial countries are tied to the transatlantic slave trade, to slavery and colonialism. The underdevelopment of the developing world are tied to those same issues. If you begin to look at the question of why the world is the way it is today and what role racism and racial discrimination have played in it, you then begin to talk about why do these glaring inequalities and difference in the quality of life of the world exist. You begin to talk about tenets of international law of in the United States English common law and in the United Kingdom English common law of when there is a victim. What do they do? What do victims do in terms of damages? What do they do in terms of repair? Reparation speaks to repair, to making someone whole, to putting them in the place they would be had there not been the crime committed against them.
The State Department's standard line is we want to be forward-looking, not mm-hmm. backward-looking.
Right. That's the mantra of all criminals, that once they have committed a crime, taken the rewards from the crime, set themselves up as quote-unquote legitimate, they say, well, let's just start from here. Let's not look back. Because what we're facing with the United States and Western Europe is basically a criminal enterprise that has now made itself look legitimate by not looking at the basis from which their seed money came and from which they continue to benefit.
We're talking to Roger Wareham, who is a human rights attorney, long involved on the international scene, specifically focusing at the United Nations and testifying often around human rights abuses of the U.S. government, often the only person who's speaking in these U.N. bodies on this issue. What about at the grassroots, who is involved with the U.N. Conference on Racism?
Yeah, what we did the December 12th movement, and when you say often the only voice, it's really a collective voice, it's an organizational voice. It's just that sometimes I get dispatched to Geneva more often than some of my other comrades. Once the World Conference was announced, we knew that given the opposition of the U.S. to the World Conference, that there was not going to be the type of publicity that was given, for instance, to the Women's Conference in Beijing, where the United States contributed at least $6 million. President Clinton's wife, now Senator Clinton, attended, that there was not going to be that kind of publicity. It had to be a grassroots effort. And so we came back and just using all the means possible to certain radio outlets that were available at that time, try to get on cable TV, have community meetings, get the word out, internet, whatever way possible to do that, particularly because, as I said in the beginning, we saw this as the opportunity that Malcolm talked about, that it would be an opportunity for black people in particular not to squander to place our situation front and center. So, you know, we hooked up with the National Black United Front that we had done work with before, who had taken a petition to Geneva in 1999 with, I think, almost 1 million signatures around our situation, in the U.S. Whatever community or the National Conference of Black Lawyers, local community organizations, the Patrice Lumumba Coalition, organizations across the country that, that dealt with that, we contacted, we let them know what was happening, we set up meetings, we went to universities, we tried to counteract whatever our lack of access to the media. We knew the corporate media was not going to address it.
Internationally, who were the other groups? And in terms of racial diversity and ethnic groupings, in addition to African, in addition to African Americans.
Certainly, a point that I had made, the title of this World Conference is the World Conference Against Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance. Xenophobia and related intolerance were added as a theme to the World Conference in order to get the Western countries to come along and agree to it. It was a compromise. The Western countries knew that if you put in xenophobia and related intolerance, you would now be able to dilute the focus on racism and racial discrimination. You would dilute the focus on white supremacy and the slave trade. You'd be able to say, for instance, that don't talk to us because look at what's happening in Africa. Look at what's happening in Rwanda. Look at the conflict between the Hutus and the Tutsis, and try and put all those on the same level and the same plate, and without even getting into how did that conflict develop, and who fostered it and who propagated it.
The most significant statement on the importance of talking about reparations came out of Dakar, the preparatory conference that took place there. Can you say what happened there?
Sure, certainly. The African group, which has been the lead group in terms of the World Conference, had their prep come in Dakar in January. They put forward a statement that basically called for the transatlantic slave trade, slavery, and colonialism, because it was important to expand that concept as a crime against humanity. It talked about the need for reparations for African people and for the African continent. It set up a vehicle, an international compensatory fund or scheme to work out the logistics of how reparations would be dealt with. The United States, before the conference, before the PrepCon was held in Dakar, had received a copy of the proposed declaration. I was at a meeting following the Dakar conference where the same woman who had headed the U.S. delegation at the PrepCon said, and this was a public meeting, she said, when we, the United States, saw this declaration, this proposed declaration, we were appalled. We thought the language was inflammatory. We were determined to go to Dakar to get the Africans to tone down their language. So the United States sent a delegation to Dakar. The president of Senegal, it was a new president, but apparently carrying on the same position as the old one, got up and said, we don't need reparations, which was a position that his own country and delegation disavowed themselves from.
Roger Wareham, we have to stop it there. I want to thank you very much for being with us, human rights attorney and member of the December 12th Movement. We'll get the rest of the story next time. If you want to get in contact with him, www.december12thmovement.bigstep.com. You can also call 718-398-1766, and we'll continue to bring you information on the UN World Conference Against Racism that will take place in Durban, South Africa, 718-398-1766. That does it for today's program, Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan, our engineer and music maestro. Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!